Joan Acocella has been writing about dance and books for The New Yorker for years. She's the author of a half a dozen books, the most recent of which, 28 Artists and Two Saints, published in 2007, was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award in Criticism, and it won the award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. At the American Academy this fall, Acocella was working on a collection of essays tentatively entitled Crime and Punishment, about the artistic treatment of the criminal, including pieces on Judas Iscariot, the Grimm Brothers, Dostoevsky, Dracula, Agatha Christie, and, not least, The Sopranos. Joan, 25 years ago, you wrote a dissertation on the Russian ballet, which ran from 1909 to 1929, and which many consider to be the greatest dance company of all time. And you're a dance critic for The New Yorker, so the obvious question is, what got you into dance?
I got into it the same way many people did in my time, and that's just completely through being a fan. The dance history wasn't taught in the universities at that time being the 70s. So all of us just sort of fell in love. And that's what happened to me. I was, at that time, getting a PhD in comparative literature. And all I ever meant to be for many years was a professor of comparative literature. But then, during a time when I had taken a money job, I fell in love with the New York City Ballet. But I no longer wanted to write the dissertation I was going to write on Italo Svevo. I wanted to write about dance. So these people were actually willing to let me write a dissertation on Diaghilev's Ballet Russe as long as I tied it to intellectual and artistic currents during that company's lifetime, 1900 and 1929. And so that's what I did.
For a lot of writers that are in Berlin, you have what is perhaps the greatest job. You're a New Yorker staff writer. How'd it come about?
Oh, I mean, you know, these things come about often by accident. And I mean, I wasn't recruited. I wrote an essay on Vasilev Nijinsky. In some measure, he was the subject of my dissertation. And he was the object of a great deal of study by me. And a new biography came out, a very, very fine biography by a man named Peter Ostwald. But I had talked about it actually to a man who was a friend of mine, Robert Gottlieb, who was also the editor-in-chief of The New Yorker. And then that was the first piece. And then if you're lucky and you've written a good piece, they will say to you, well, what are you going to write about next? Mm-hmm. But I wrote for The New Yorker for 6 years before I became their dance critic. And now I actually spend more time writing about books than I do writing about dance. Mm-hmm. For one thing, The New Yorker wants book reviews more than they want dance reviews. But for another thing, we're somewhat in dog days with dance. The world of books is much wider than the world of dance.
Yeah.
There's almost no time when you can't find something you like. And I feel that it's bad for critics to write about work that they don't care about that much. It turns them either into hypocrites or into terrible, grouchy old fogies.
This is the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin. You're listening to a conversation with Joan Acocella of The New Yorker. Is part of an artist or writer's purview also making moral choices? And are aesthetic choices that they're making also, in some ways, moral choices?
I have certain interests. I mean, a primary interest, other than literary excellence, is moral choices.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very often interested in writers who talk about moral choices, but I'm also interested in writers who've made moral choices. I think that the profession of writing, or the profession of being an artist, is extremely hard. And I admire them. They are pulling out of themselves very often the deepest stuff that they have. And also, writers very often have terrible setbacks. One person I wrote about, Margaret Yourcenar, had a very, very, very long writer's block. Dorothy Parker, like a number of Americans of her period and the following decades, destroyed her career with alcohol. There are others in there who had great difficulties. Sometimes in the middle, like Yourcenar, but very often, of course, at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
when they were trying to find themselves. And very often at the beginning, they try to write everything in the world. they haven't found their subject and they don't trust themselves yet. So you see them kind of lost and trying to do every card trick they have in order to make something interesting. So you ask whether these people have anything in common. I think they had a lot of moral problems. By morals, I mean something very broad. The ability to overcome disappointment, humaneness. A lot of them are writing about moral matters. Certainly Primo Levi is, for example. So is Susan Sontag. Dorothy Parker is writing about cynicism. H.L. Mencken is writing about stupidity. Morals is the word I use. I don't want to call it psychology because so many people associate psychology with psychopathology. And one of the things that I'm very concerned to get across is that in the face of a lot of writings that artists are neurotic, and particularly if they have problems, then they're neurotic. I think artists are not neurotic. I think they're among the least neurotic. The most honest, they have the most tenacity. I mean, it's not as though I love every artist, but I'm interested in their difficulties.
I mean, that brings up a good point about how much an artist or a poet or a writer feels that he or she should self-express. For example, a counterargument is that T.S. Eliot said that poetry is not an escape into emotion. It's an escape away
from emotion. Yeah.
Escape from emotion. And Flaubert thought the same thing. Where is self-expression now as a mode of doing art? Is it passé in a way? Is it
Well, certainly not in dance, but not in books either. I mean, I truly believe that with dance, for example, that all good dance is moral in some sense. It has some connection to our lives. It tells us about the things that are important to us. It tells us how to behave toward each other, even if it's completely abstract. And I'm thinking of a lot of Balanchine's work. I think that people wouldn't go to dance concerts if it didn't mean something about their lives. I don't think that any art is completely abstract, but certainly not dance. I think my favorite kind of dance is actually very formal, you know, dance that some people would consider abstract, in which nevertheless a lot of moral meaning leaks through. Balanchine was my first great lodestar as a choreographer, but then I became very interested in Mark Morris, who does much the same thing. Both of those men also made story ballets, and I like their story ballets very much. I love Balanchine's Nutcracker. I love Mark Morris's Dido and Aeneas, but I am very touched by that, I won't call it a trick, but that way of respecting the art, giving you the art, the musical tones, the dance steps, whatever, and still telling a human story. In dance, we had a very long period of political art from the 80s and 90s, set off by political problems in the country. Feminism and the AIDS crisis, I would say, foremost, and also by certain artistic influences, one of which was Pina Bausch, who arrived in the United States in 1983 and had a big effect. A highly emotionalized work, which I think many people felt was expressing her feelings about modern history, that it was chaotic and without meaning, and full of violence and despair. But in answer to your question, you know, it's just too various. I mean, Mark Morris is still out there making abstract work, and so was Merce Cunningham until he died 2 years ago, and so is Paul Taylor, and so is Christopher Wheeldon. These people would be called, I think, formalists. But all the work is emotionalized. And then, but then, you know, particularly I would say in downtown dance, more modern dance, and what they would call experimental dance, although I don't know how many experiments are in them. No, they don't need to be. I don't need work to be experimental. It can be very traditional as far as I'm concerned, just as long as it's good. But you're going to see more self-expression there.
You're listening to the Berlin Journal. We're talking with journalist and critic Joan Acocella.
I'm going to shift gears for one second and come back to what you're working on at the Academy. Not too long ago, you gave a lecture that was about the book that you're working on, which is about evil, broadly conceived. You spoke about the television series, The Sopranos, which you love. And you also talked about some of the other essays that you're including in this book. There's one about Judas Iscariot. There's one about Giordano Bruno. There's one about the Grimm brothers, Dracula, Agatha Christie, and Stieg Larsson. Is this book conceived of as a cultural history of evil, something like Andrew Del Banco's Death of Satan, which was about how the concept of evil in America has sort of dissipated over the last 200 years? Or are they more scenes from a concept that is very much alive and very much in our midst?
Well, I'll tell you that this book is still a cooking in my brain. That was true also of 28 Artists. So I don't really have a clear answer to your question, and sometimes I don't know what I think until I write it. Mm-hmm. You'll see here in that list many different concepts of evil and many different angles on it. For example, Judas Iscariot, we don't even know if he existed. Mm-hmm. So what you're talking about there is a history of attitudes toward evil.
And betrayal.
Yes, a betrayal above all, and which I think for a lot of people is the worst sin. The Grimm brothers, the question there is how such terrible cruelty can be contained in what are superficially charming tales for children. And also, that one would raise the question, the Grimm brothers, of whether different nations have different attitudes toward evil. The Grimm brothers are very much associated with Germany, and they very much associated themselves with Germany. They felt that their work was teaching people to be more German. And the work is very nationalist. So the Grimm brothers, one would want to talk about history in relation to them. And of course, German history. Dracula is a concept of, I mean, I think today a lot of people would regard the Dracula story as camp. But at the same time, we have the huge explosion recently of vampire movies and novels and TV programs. But to get to what is your more serious question, which is, are we more interested in evil right now than we have been before? No, I think it just takes different forms. It's, you know, but it's like there's more sex, too. The difference, I believe, is that transgressiveness is more allowed. So you get Dexter, you know, a serial killer killing serial killers. You get The Sopranos, which is about a bunch of gangsters, and they do kill people. But, you know, Dracula was born in the early 19th century. And if you look at Jacobean drama, the drama that came right after Shakespeare, you know, there are beheadings. And people, you know, cut open people's chests and rip their hearts out, you know? And actually, you know, if you look at Macbeth, with Lady Macbeth saying, you know, who knew that he had so much blood in him? Look, Oedipus, you know, he pokes his eyes out. We don't see it on the stage. We don't see Jocasta hang herself. But there it is. Odysseus and his boys stick a burning pike into the Cyclops' eye. There's been a lot of violence. You're absolutely right that it's more lurid now.
Let me ask you one final question. It's not another thing. How's Berlin?
It's just fascinating to see Germany deal with its history. Of course, one is extremely impressed by the historical aspect. I'm the kind of person who's always saying, get over it. And also, I feel that most of the people who fought in the Second World War are dead. And it seems to me cruel that their children and grandchildren should have to suffer. and be constantly faced with the idea of whether their nation, indeed their ethnic group, is intrinsically evil. This seems to me immensely cruel, not to speak of inaccurate and inappropriate. But I did go to the Holocaust Monument, and I can see why they've still got it on their minds. Mm. You know, it makes a lot of difference to the way you think about life if you've ever had a war take place on your own soil. In America, that hasn't happened since 1812, I think. But there's a kind of tragic sense of life that people who had the war happen on their ground and then people who lost the war. Yeah. But, you know, I don't have on my wall pictures of people who were killed in the war. If you look at Renoir's Grand Illusion, this is a different war now, but when Jean Gabin gets to the house of that woman who's on the border with Switzerland and stays at the house, on a certain night, she points to the pictures on the wall and she says, well, there's my Uncle Heinrich, who died, you know, in such a place. And there's my Uncle Ricard. And there's my Uncle Hans, or my cousin Hans. When you have a history like that, as you walk down the street, as you look at your walls, you have a different attitude toward life. Sometimes I'm insulted by it, but I understand sometimes why Europeans think that Americans are naive. Mm. And I think they are still affected by the fact that they capitulated so fast. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so that's how I feel about Berlin. Yeah. I sometimes bewildered.
Thanks for joining us on the Berlin Journal.
You're quite welcome. Thanks. Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Joan Acacella on the Berlin Journal. Coming up, political scientist Jonathan Lawrence.
I am Netta Ulubi, arts reporter. NPR sets me free to throw open the doors to museums and theaters, little and large. We bring you to recording studios, movie sets, boardrooms, and into the policy discussions affecting artists, authors, musicians. NPR introduces you to the outstanding people who make our lives richer through creative expression. Their books, their movies, their music, our world. This is NPR.
Welcome back to the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide. I'm RJ McGill. Political scientist Jonathan Lawrence is working on a research project called Turkey and Morocco in Germany, European Muslims or Citizens Abroad, which examines the external impact of Turkish and Moroccan projection of soft power across the Mediterranean, particularly following the Arab Spring. In Berlin, he is looking at Germans and other Europeans' integration approaches and the resistance to them, for the 8 million or so Turkish and Moroccan origin residents and citizens who live across Western Europe. He's in Berlin to speak with experts and officials to complete the German piece of his research puzzle. To that end, he sat down with Spiegel Online's Charles Hawley to talk about Muslim integration, far-right politics in Europe, and the state of German immigration reform.
Primarily, I know that you're mostly focused on integration, Muslims in Europe. The debate in Germany I find to be somewhat unique. In Bonn, a small party of anti-Islamist populists decided in their campaign for the state elections to display Muhammad caricatures in front of Muslim facilities. And they engendered the response that was perhaps not surprising, but was nonetheless unfortunate when the Salafists then attacked the police protecting the small demonstration. How is it that such a small, tiny group could define the debate about Islam in the German press for months?
Well, there are two tiny groups in that case that are defining the German debate rather unhelpfully at the same time. And each has, you know, its own place of primacy, even though they're really quite small. Point Hervé has its most recent experience in the public realm as the prime mover behind a campaign against the construction of a grand mosque in Köln city center, which is not far from the main cathedral. And their plan to build a mosque in central Cologne inspired this small coalition of self-anointed anti-Islamization prophets, basically, who view any sign of permanence of Islam in Germany or indeed in neighboring countries to be a real challenge to the country's fundamental identity. So out of really very small numbers, they were able to mount this very visible campaign against the construction of the mosque, and this led to some real significant clashes. That fact brought out, I think, some of the worst in the Muslim origin population, in that the mainstream organizations, which are nearly, you know, basically all of them, said, well, you know, if you don't want us to have a transparent, you know, visible, proper mosque in the city center, then why do you criticize the prayer spaces that we have that are in the second courtyard? We're just trying to make ourselves at home here. And so the Point Hervé movement has its roots in this, and wound up provoking this Salafist fringe within the organized Muslim community, which is really tiny. We're talking in the low thousands for the entire country.
You spoke also of the fact that the Point Hervé is interested in maintaining the identity of that region of Germany as a whole. When talking to them, of course, they also emphasize, or they primarily emphasize, that they are there to defend democracy. Is that an honest argument on their part?
Not entirely. If you allow that this democracy, with its constitution, upholds religious freedom. And what they are objecting to within Islamic organizations, within Islamic milieu in Germany, is more a result of Islam's not having found analogous institutional structures to the churches and synagogues and other religious communities that have been here for a while. The German constitution, the Grundgesetz, took over from the Weimar constitution a whole section concerning religious freedom. Allowing for religious communities to be formed, allowing for religious communities to be recognized as public law corporations, and to enjoy certain privileges. So to teach in public schools an hour of religion each week, to collect some funds, revenue, church taxes for the running of the community, to have a seat on the boards of certain public broadcasting corporations. There's a whole range of privileges, which Muslims, now that they are becoming more and more part of the citizenry, are asking for access to, quite naturally. So the idea that preventing them from exercising their constitutional rights is a defense of democracy is somewhat disingenuous. But what they're objecting to in the Point Hervé kind of circles are the radical fringes of the religion.
What is it about that political background that makes Germany prone to these periodic orgies of angst?
Well, Germany has this funny experience of dual dictatorship in the 20th century, which has really conditioned the way that citizens experience democracy. And, you know, the West German Federal Republic was already quite constrained in its international degrees of freedom because of its anchoring in NATO, but also because of the American occupation, etc. And then, of course, the Soviet occupation, which wound up taking the form of the East German Democratic Republic, extended also an experience, essentially, of totalitarianism from the Nazi period of the Third Reich. And so I think that those two experiences of dictatorship as perceived from the West led to a whole series of restrictions on, you know, how far freedoms should be allowed to go because of the risk of their spilling over into intolerance. And so in a kind of anti-fascist, you know, broadly speaking, mentality of no freedom for the enemies of freedom developed. And, of course, to have activities on the political extremes is perfectly natural in Western democracies. I mean, it's not possible that the parliamentary party system simply covers everyone. And if you have a freedom of opinion, then you have to expect that there are going to be some people out there with really nasty opinions. But it's very hard for, I think, Germans who feel quite responsible for those experiences of dictatorship and ensuring that they never occur again. So it's often coming from a kind of well-intentioned place when they want to prevent the spread of Islamism. That's not just Poinave, that's German government policy, essentially. They don't speak to groups that define themselves as Islamists, even if they're nonviolent. So the aims of that are perfectly understandable. They don't want to come to a situation where there's a religious, you know, theocracy.
Is that also a function of the way the debate tends to be led in Germany? For example, you have Chancellor Merkel saying that multiculturalism has failed. You've had several other politicians saying similar things in Germany in recent years. Does that push the debate out to the fringes?
So there was a structural obstacle to integration for the first 40 years of the settlement of guest workers in Germany. So from 1960 until 2000, access to citizenship, to the German nationality, was simply very, very difficult. It was not impossible, but the naturalization rates were really 10%, 20% at most in the most migrant-friendly Länder. This led to a situation of, you know, a democratic deficit. You had a population of several million, born and raised in a million of those cases in Germany, with no access to the formal political system. So the parties also had no incentive to really be inclusive of them, so long as they weren't voters. This meant that within the parties, you had very few contacts, very little outreach, again, very little incentive to do outreach, and the only government offices coming into contact with these communities were those responsible for foreigners. So that meant they had their own foreigner councils. Their religion would be managed essentially through the foreign ministry that would channel mosque funding and imams from the countries of origin, largely Turkey, into Germany. And that was the situation really up until a decade ago, or a little bit more, when in 1999 the Red-Green Coalition changed the citizenship law and made it easier for people born here to become German nationals. That reshapes the political landscape permanently. But we haven't felt it yet because it's only been 12 years. So the first generation of native-born German Muslims really is in, you know, secondary school right now. I expect that as they mature and as they join the various political parties, which they are doing, that the political system will come to reflect their views. And if you look at it just objectively, elected politicians in Germany do reflect the diversity, actually, of the immigrant population, albeit in proportion to those who are actually citizens. So it doesn't seem like a lot, but there are a lot of people of immigrant origins who still aren't citizens because of the old citizenship law that was in effect until so recently.
This is the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin. You're listening to Spiegel Online's Charles Hawley speaking with political scientist Jonathan Lawrence about Muslim integration in Germany.
Looking around Germany, of course, one would imagine that Germany has been tremendously successful in a lot of ways because of the fact that these right-wing populist groups seem to be so tiny. Is that a function of German political parties having been able to speak to them on the fringes and collect them within their own fold, or is it more of a function of Germany's history?
It's probably a bit of both, and I don't know how long it can stay that way as a result. Certainly the taboo of far-right activism after the Second World War in West Germany was absolute, and there was renewal of that anti-extremist fervor in the early 90s after the reunification of West and East. That scared the big political parties. And so the response to the explosion of xenophobia was, in a sense, sending the wrong signal, because it was kind of suggesting that people are fed up, there's too many immigrants, and we have to find a way to start, you know, stemming that tide. That was the early 90s, and I think that that and the slogan at the time, which Germany is not a country of immigration, which was repeated kind of mindlessly for years in contradiction of the reality around them, led to a feeling on the right, yes, that the conservative stance vis-a-vis whether or not Germany should become a kind of diverse society was the dominant one. That all changed with the Red-Green Coalition in 98 to 05, and then after 2005, the Conservative Party in government actually was the most progressive when it came to embracing Islam as a religion of Germany. Now, I think that shuffles the cards a bit, because those on the extremes don't really have their mainstream mode, you know, of expression, however indirect. I don't think that there's, you know, a rumbling of nationalist sentiment in Germany. There is some, as you would expect in the certain areas. You're not going to have a large far-right political party like you do in France, though.
Earlier this year, you wrote, I believe it was in the New York Times, saying that right-wing parties in a number of these countries have been responsible for a lot of laws against sort of outward signs of belonging to the Muslim minority. Do they really have that much power?
I think there's a fear of certain demons in the electorate that if a kind of firmness is not shown now at this critical turning point when the Muslim minority is becoming irrevocably part of the citizenry, there aren't firm kind of limits being set on the religion and its outward expression, then some segment of the electorate could bolt for a strong leader or a party that puts his foot down. The restrictions, however, are not all anti-Islamic, right? Some of the framework that Islam as an organized religion is being asked to adapt to is the same framework that other religions have had to adapt to. I suppose what you're observing, though, is a shift from simply a desire to put Islam in the same kind of institutional box that other religions are also put in. It's moved to a greater skepticism about Islam in the public sphere generally. And it goes to something much more existential about whether or not Muslims can really be Muslims in Germany or Europe. And I'm referring here to the attempts to ban halal slaughter, and by extension kosher slaughter, and the attempts to ban ritual circumcision, which also affects both Muslim and Jewish communities. And those two are interesting examples because they're not visible in the public sphere. It's not just that we don't want our societies to look like where you guys came from. It's that we also don't really want you to do what makes you you.
One wonders sometimes, or at least I do, whether the Muslim issue for some of these populist parties is also something of a Trojan horse. I don't doubt that they are sincerely concerned about the spread of Islam. A lot of the populist parties share that issue. They share skepticism of the euro, and they share skepticism of immigration as such. It seems sometimes as if it's sort of a Trojan horse for a reintroduction of nationalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you are putting your finger on, you know, the rejection of globalization, which is not so recent, but which has become more mainstream, and I think has, you're right, been incorporated into populist party platforms. As some of that Euroscepticism has been proven accurate with respect to the currency union, at least, I think that those skeptics have been comforted and strengthened. The reaction to immigration, which I think you're right, is also bundled up in this, is related but somewhat distinct. Because that, I think, does have to do with preserving some myth of a monolithic native population that really never was.
One of the things that I've done a lot of reporting on is the FPÖ party in Austria. And one of the things that they've been really trying to do is to broaden their platform a little bit beyond just anti-anti and try to show themselves as being also fluent in foreign policy. I've had people in the party tell me that they want to show themselves as being sort of statesmanly. Do you think that these sorts of parties could eventually just become another mainstream party?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, the FPÖ is a good example, right? Because when Haider was still alive and in control of the party and the party made it into a coalition, you'll recall that the European partners actually boycotted the government, you know, disinvited them from summits and canceled meetings. That was a pretty strong signal. That is, I think, a sign of at least the current generation's political instinct, which is to know that they, as mainstream parties, are threatened above all. And so they have an interest in either districting them out or, you know, adjusting the electoral rule. And this is has happened, you know, in France. The way that they elect the National Assembly was altered to avoid far-right parties coming in. However, as the issues you mentioned that spur populism tend to increase in visibility and not fade, then you're right. They will become harder to avoid, or at least their issues will become harder to avoid. So either all the planks in their platform will be lifted and incorporated into, you know, the center-right, or, depending on the parliamentary system, they can make themselves an indispensable coalition partner just with their 5 or 10 or 12%. I don't think we have to see this as being some inexorable rise of extremism. I think we have to see it as a constant buzz with, frankly, you know, a lot of wood to feed that fire. And therefore, the mainstream parties have to be very attentive not to exclude the important issues from the debate anymore, right? And some of these important issues have been raised by the extremes.
One final question about Germany, perhaps. Is there a chance that Germany could see the rise of a significant or influential right-wing populist party?
I don't think there's really a need for one. Right now, the CSU in Bavaria does vocalize, I think, a lot of the identity-related concerns of conservative Germans across the country. Right now they're in government, so, you know, I think that that pressure is being vented. There is a larger question about what's going to happen when people of Turkish background, people of Muslim background, really start participating in politics. And I don't mean, you know, the hundreds of kids demonstrating in the street about cartoons. That's really not significant when you compare it to the extensive organizational field, associational field. There are huge federations representing hundreds of thousands of people who are, you know, very responsible, who are starting to engage in electoral mobilization, albeit at a small scale. But as that grows, you have to expect there to be some kind of pushback. And the way that the mainstream parties manage that pushback will determine, of course, the direction that the minority takes in terms of their own turn inwards or radicalization or need to find other representatives than the mainstream political parties, and in turn will interact with any folks on the far right who will either be pacified and reassured or, you know, on the contrary, stirred up further. So it's really too soon to tell. The, you know, institutions of the German democracy disfavor the rise of the far right through parliamentary thresholds and through the observation by the security offices and, you know, as you've said, just the taboo against it, which does survive past the Cold War generation, I believe. So I think Germany would really be the last of the countries that we've discussed to tolerate any kind of hint of a return to the past.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with political scientist Jonathan Lawrence. After the break, literary translator Peter Constantine reads a bit of Chekhov. Early in the spring of 1892, Anton Chekhov, a new star on the Russian literary scene, fled Moscow city life for the seclusion of Melikovo, a small country estate he had just bought in order to take up farming. He was just 32 years old and at the height of his creative powers, and he had just published over 400 short stories, plays, and other vignettes in the course of the preceding decade. Translator Peter Constantine was awarded the National Translation Award for his Undiscovered Chekhov, 38 New Stories, in 1999, and is currently working on a few more. He sat down with the Berlin Journal to read a story Chekhov wrote about his move to Melikovo, recast as a recently retired man's diary entries. We're here with Peter Constantine, who is a fellow at the Academy this semester, and he has given us a piece for the Berlin Journal magazine, a late piece by Anton Chekhov that he's translated. And Peter, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this piece from the Notebook of a Country Squire, it is from Chekhov's mature years when he was already writing long stories such as The Lady with the Little Dog, The Duel. Also, he was preparing his great theatre career, which we know him now for. And this story is much more typical, let's say, of his earlier writing that he'd been doing a decade earlier, where he was publishing literally hundreds of pieces in all the top magazines at the time, two or three pieces a week sometimes. Mm. It is unusual in the sense that it is almost experimental.
There's probably no better way to get a grasp of the piece than to have you read it. Would you mind reading it for us?
Oh, I'd like to read it, yes. From the Notebook of a Country Squire by Anton Chekhov. Upon his retirement, State Councillor Kaprikornov bought himself a small country estate on which he settled. There, in imitation partly of Cincinnatus, partly of the mushroom specialist Professor Kai Gorodov, he toiled the land and recorded his observations on nature. After his death, his notes, along with the rest of his property, were transferred by his last will and testament to his housekeeper, Marfa Evlampievna, a devoted old soul who had the manor house pulled down and a sturdy tavern that sold liquor built in its place. This tavern had a special clean room for travelling landowners and officials, and on the table in that room she placed the deceased's bundle of notes in case someone needed a piece of scrap paper. One of these pieces of paper has fallen into my hands. From what I could surmise, it must have been from the beginning of the deceased's agricultural notes, and contains the following entries. March 3rd. The birds of spring are now arriving. Yesterday I saw some sparrows. Greetings to you, O children of southern climes. In your sweet chirping, I believe I hear you calling back to me, and a good day to you too, Your Excellency. March 14th. Today I asked Marfa Evlampievna, why does our cockerel crow so often? Her answer, because he has a throat. So I said, I too have a throat, and yet I do not crow. Oh, the mysteries of nature. All the years I served in St. Petersburg, I often ate turkeys, but saw my first live one yesterday, a most remarkable bird. March 22nd. The village constable came by. We had a long talk, I seated, he standing, about the virtues. As we conversed, he asked me, if given the opportunity, Your Excellency, would you wish to be young again? To which I replied, no, I would not. If I were young again, I would not have the high rank I have attained. He agreed with me, and visibly moved, went on his way. April 16th. With my own hands I dug 2 vegetable beds in the garden, and sowed semolina in them. I did not tell a soul about this, as I wanted the semolina beds to be a surprise for dear Marfa Evlampievna, to whom I owe so many happy moments. Yesterday, as we were having tea, she lamented the condition her figure was in, complaining that her size no longer allowed her to fit through the pantry door. I remarked to her, "On the contrary, my dearest, the fullness of your form frames you most wonderfully and fans my inclination." She blushed, and I stood up and embraced her with both hands, as one can no longer reach around her with just one. May 28th. An old man who saw me by the women's bathing place asked me why I was sitting there, to which I replied, "I am keeping watch to make sure that no young men approach." "Let us both keep watch," the old man said, and, sitting down next to me, we began to discuss the virtues.
This is R.J. McGill for the Berlin Journal talking with literary translator Peter Constantine.
Now, you've translated a lot of Chekhov.
Over 100 stories now, I'd say.
And what is it about these little sort of fragmentary entries that you found different from the other things that you've translated?
Well, many of these early pieces, or lesser-known pieces, let's say, many of them that haven't been translated into English yet, are pieces in different forms. So you have maybe a story written as if it were a census report. You might have a story written like a lawyer's protocol with a stamp on it. You have bits of diary. You have maybe a homework assignment by a harebrained 16-year-old country girl. Anything that Chekhov puts his pen to, anything that he tries, seems to just work and work in new and surprising ways.
Do you have a favorite story that you've translated?
Oh, I would say I have very many favorites. I like the ones that are in diary forms or bits of paper that happen to have been found somewhere. Or there's a story where a woman goes through her husband's a bag and finds receipts and scraps of torn up paper, and she reads them, and that's what the story is. So I like that. I think it's sort of a brave new way of writing. If we think about it, this was 1880, 1882, 83. So it was quite daring.
You're translating from presumably just into English from the Russian. Is there something that sort of discloses itself to you differently when it's in these forms, or more intriguingly when it's in diary form or sort of entry form, that seems more intimate than a standard short story or a standard play?
Well, Chekhov is one of the writers who I've always enjoyed translating, and I must say probably the writer I've enjoyed translating most. As a translator, if a writer is in the grip of inspiration, let's say, and his writing jumps from the page and there is this lightness of being, then you as a translator in a sense are grabbed by that and taken along with that, and it is much easier to do than a writer who might be struggling and having trouble with his sentences or her sentences. It's just not working out somehow. With Chekhov, it always seems to work, so it is a delight, I would say, to translate him.
How many languages do you actually translate from?
I translate from many of the European languages. I've done quite a bit of German, which is my mother tongue as well, and Greek, which is in a sense also my mother tongue. I grew up there. And Russian is what I've translated most from. I mean, if we're doing a page count. Albanian as well.
Is there a particular either writer or kind of writing that you enjoy going back to?
Well, for me, the major stylists were Anton Chekhov, Isaac Babel, of whom I did the complete works for Norton about 10 years ago, and Machiavelli, who is also, for me, an absolute exquisite stylist, where everything counts, every word, every comma, every breath in the sentence counts. So that's a joy to translate.
As someone who's living in Germany, how did you get into translation in the beginning, and when did you realize this is going to be my profession?
Well, language was always very main interest for me, and the very first book I did was called Japanese Street Slang, which back in the 80s people were very interested in the Japanese language, but not all that much had been done. It was a new... Japan was a major, major world power at the time, and everyone wanted to learn Japanese. And Japanese street slang was a sort of an antidote to all the college textbooks, which only taught very, very formal language. So that was the introduction into publishing. The okay. first book I translated were six early stories by Thomas Mann, and I was in my 20s at the time. I came across these stories that had not been translated into English, so I translated them, and it was a wonderful experience to do that translation. I was hooked. I mean, I knew after that this is what I want to do, and since then I've only been translating. It's what I do every day with great joy. That book was also successful. It won the Penn Translation Prize and opened all kinds of doors to translating.
Are there any challenges yet unmatched?
Oh, I would like to translate Boccaccio. There are also very many Machiavelli pieces that have not been done, which I would like to do at some point. So probably, yes, the next two things I'd like to do would be Italian, I think.
Well, thank you for joining us on the Berlin Journal.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to an interview with literary translator Peter Constantine. We also heard interviews today with journalist Joan Acacella of The New Yorker and political scientist Jonathan Lawrence, who was interviewed by Charles Hawley of Spiegel Online. The Berlin Journal is a production of the American Academy in Berlin and National Public Radio. For more on the American Academy in Berlin, please visit our website, americanacademy.de, and for more on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide, please visit the website nprberlin.de. Our production team includes Melanie Sevchenko in Berlin and Sarah Richards in Washington. I'm your host, RJ McGill. Thanks for joining us on the Berlin Journal and Auf Wiedersehen. Oh, and one last thing.